do is validate parking. This is part of our continuing education series. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about fiduciary issues, as if we haven't had enough of those today. Actually, this is good, because I just want to take a couple of minutes. I'm going to get away from behind this podium, because I don't like talking behind podiums. But I just want to spend a couple of minutes on some fundamental things, go over a few of the papers that we put in the packet, and then I'm going to depart from this, because, you know, what's that wonderful economist who said talk's cheap because the supply exceeds the demand? That's a supply side guy. Anyway, we can talk about these principles, you know, and they're in the Constitution, they're in the 37 Act, and they sound great, and it's a nice bunch of words all strung together. But as you can see from both what we do in open session and what we do in closed session, putting a lot of this into action and trying to get that sense of where the balance lies and what your fiduciary responsibilities are in practice is really tough. And so I kind of set this up. We've done this before. I've changed some of these scenarios to try to reflect some of the things that not just a hypothetical board, but a real board faces on a regular basis. And I want to get your input on that and some conversation on that. The materials are really meant to be kind of a checklist for you, just to go back, a refresher, fundamental fiduciary duties. I put them on the screen here. Happy to give you the slides, but in the materials that you've got, you know, we've talked about these duties. I've outlined them in exhibits, what the Constitution says, and I want to use this as a checklist and talk through some of them that appear in the Code of Fiduciary Conduct and Ethics. I don't want to talk too much in specifics about personal financial interests and that sort of thing. We face those when they come up from time to time, but that's a little bit too much in the weeds, I think, for this discussion. They're there in some excerpts from the government code for you. But let's just get the framework while everybody's eating and digesting. There really are three fundamental fiduciary rules that we're always dealing with, and they have some flexibility. My job, I feel, as fiduciary counsel to you, is to kind of act as a gyroscope to sort of keep the ship floating, heading in the right direction, and balanced. I try to do that with this board in an active way, and also in how we tee up certain issues. We face a lot of issues that trigger each of these rules, and they come out differently. And there are no hard and fast black and white places where we can say yes or no, I should act this way or I should act a different way. And one of the things, I mean, let's just take the first one, the primary loyalty rule. The primary loyalty, you see it's in the California Constitution. This is on, if you looked at in the materials on this agenda item, I'll be referring to the handwritten page numbers down in the right corner. So on page 4, the constitutional duties are there. They're reflected in the 37 Act. Primary loyalty rule is that your loyalty is to the members and beneficiaries of the system, all of the members and beneficiaries of the system. It's your primary obligation, not just current members, not just deferred or retired members, but to everybody. Comment I want to make on that, which sort of goes to things we've already talked about today. This is what's called an interested board. There are other kind of boards. Pension funds have other kind of boards. The Ontario Teachers Pension Fund, one of the biggest ones in Canada, completely different approach to what a board composition should be. Those board members, there are no active members or retired members of Ontario Teachers who sit on that board. They're a disinterested board. They're chosen because they have absolutely no contact with anything They're just selected as outside experts, and they are the Board of Trustees of Ontario Teachers. That's not what we do in California. In California, the people, for whatever reason, good to the people from 1930s on, have said these boards are going to be made up of people who have an interest in what's going on. And that means some of the members of the board are disinterested, outsiders who are appointed by the Board of Supervisors. But we also allow a supervisor to be on the board, specifically written in the statute that a supervisor may be on this board. We have elected active members of the system who are on the board, retired members of the system. So this is crafted as people who come here from various constituencies with various ideas about how the system should be run, and then you walk through that door and you sit at this table, and your charge is to throw all those hats aside and say, okay, my responsibility is to the members and beneficiaries of the system first and foremost. We'll talk about that in the context in some of these scenarios. It's a difficult thing to do because what you consider to be in the best interest of all the members of the system, everybody brings their own judgment to. The nice thing about these boards are, unlike the New York Comptroller, who runs a New York pension fund singly, one individual, no Board of Trustees, this is a collective effort. We govern ourselves collectively. And that's why underlying this whole, one of the things I keep reiterating, these are the rules written into the Constitution, but there's another rule that I think is very important. It's because we act collectively that there has to be a level of trust and confidence and respect that you have in each other. And you build that up over time, and you build that up over the process that you follow in making prudent decisions. But that is a pledge that you have to each other, that you're going to enhance the ability to make a collective decision because of the trust and respect that you afford each one of you, and hopefully that you each earn from your colleagues. So there will be times when the law will not tell you what's a good thing to do, or whether to recuse yourself in a situation or not, or whether you're biased in a situation or not. But if you step back and reflect on how your colleagues would like you to, would expect you to, how you would expect your colleagues to behave in that situation, that will be really important guidance, because decision by decision can be made on its merits and how you feel about it. But collectively, you're going to keep making decisions. We're going to come back to the actuarial issues every single year. And we need that level, that fundamental level of trust and confidence in each other, that those decisions are going to be made impartially, independently, with the best judgment you can make under the circumstances and the information available to you, and that you're trying to do that as impartially as possible. One of the things you'll see in the primary loyalty rule, this comes up all the time. There's a phrase in the Constitution, I think it's in the 37 Act 2, that talks about that you also have a duty to minimize employer contributions. And that is a phrase, certainly since the crash of 08 and 09, that has been bandied about from board to board to board. What does that mean? Don't we have to reduce employer contributions and take into consideration the financial stress that employers are under? I want to tell you where that came from, because it's really instructive. Minimizing employer contributions does not mean excusing employers from making the necessary contributions to fund the system. That's not what it is. Actually, the phrase the duty to minimize employer contributions had nothing whatsoever to do with actuarial issues when it was put in the Constitution. This was a phrase that was put in the Constitution in 1984 with Prop 21. Prop 21 Before Prop 21 in 1984, the boards like this were restricted in the assets that they could invest in. And the history of funding pension funds, this fund as well as others, was basically bond market. You know, the treasurers of the counties invested in the bond market, clipped coupons back in the day where you actually clip coupons. And that was it. It was funded through the bond market. And then in the 70s, boards were given the ability to put their toe in the water of public securities. It wasn't until 1984 and Prop 21 that boards like this were given the ability under the Constitution to invest in broad equity markets. There was a concern at the time expressed in the legislature that if we took the restraints off retirement board trustees on what they could invest in a defined benefit plan, that they would go to Vegas, go to the gambling casinos. That's what the stock market was. It was essentially one big casino. And there was a real concern that knowing that you had a deep pocket upstairs in the hotel room, that you could go to Vegas and sit down at the table and gamble at the employer's expense. And this language was written into the Constitution for the purpose of restraining, trying to put some restraint, some duty on retirement board trustees from gambling extensively in the equities markets, from making imprudent decisions, knowing that they had, you know, this was a defined benefit plan. It wasn't going to affect the benefits. It was only going to be at the cost of the employers and cause their contributions to ratchet up. So that language had nothing to do with picking 30-year amortizations and, you know, reducing contributions today and kicking the can down the road. It had nothing to do with actuarial issues at all. Huh. It had solely to do with putting on some restraint on what a prudent investor will do in the marketplace. It's been completely distorted since then. It's been used as a talisman for people who say, you know, the plan, the employer should be hit upon to pay as little as possible towards the benefits. Really has nothing to do with that. And we all know from the actuarial science that's brought to you every year that it's, you know, actuarial contribution streams are really just a timing issue. And the longer you kick it out, it actually costs more. So when you string out, when you reduce the current contribution rates by a longer amortization than a shorter amortization, you're actually costing the employer more over time. You're just changing the timing of the stream of payments. And so I wanted to point that out in terms of this first primary loyalty rule, that the loyalty really is focused on funding the system. You are funding the promises that have been made, whether they're good promises, bad promises, whether they were well-made promises at the time, whatever that is, that's the plan that you've been delivered, and your obligation is to properly fund it for the members and beneficiaries today, tomorrow, off into the future. The second one, the exclusive benefit rule, but this really is an issue of what are the assets for and what should be your goals. The Department of Labor has very, you know, because they regulate ERISA plans, the Department of Labor has some very specific regulations on what you can do with assets of a pension plan. And they're meant to pay the benefits and the expenses of administering the benefits. They're not designed to allow you to further other, whether it's social goals or policy goals that you might have. They're there to get the benefits paid. And it's literally an exclusive benefit rule, not a priority benefit rule. Really exclusive. The prudent person rule, the third rule, this ties in with what I was talking about, Prop 21. The prudent expert, notice that the rule is referred to as a prudent expert rule, not a prudent person rule. really very different. The standard that you're held to is one of an expert. And this is why you're allowed to delegate and then monitor people you delegate to, because you can't, no one here, unless you're in the field, can be an expert actuary, an expert investment manager, an expert in all the other fields, an expert benefits manager. You have to have the right to delegate what you have to people who are experts, who will inform you, and then you can make a judgment on these things based on the best information you can get. That's why, to be prudent, you have to gather as much information about a subject that you can to make you comfortable on a collective basis that you're making an intelligent decision. That's the standard you're held to. With the old saying, I think some judge once said, it's not enough to have a good heart but an empty head. Your intentions are not enough to be prudent. You may have good intentions, but if you don't educate yourself, if you don't bring in the right people to help establish a foundation on which you can make an intelligent decision, you're not carrying out your duty of prudence. And the other thing I'm going to point out at this point is the last one, which I left off the materials, but it kind of goes without saying, you have to obey the law. You're a public official. We have a long list. You can see from the materials. We have codes. We have the Brown Act. We have the Public Records Act. We have the Political Reform Act. We have Section 1090 on conflicts of interest. We even have the Securities Exchange Act. I mean, the SEC is now prosecuting municipal issuers of bonds because of their representations of their pension debt in their bond offering documents. Those representations come from boards like this one. And the representations that we make about the obligations that the employer has that go into our CAFR, then go into the county and the district's CAFR and their financial statements, and go into their bond documents when they go into the bond market to borrow. And there are SEC-imposed obligations, not only in that context that affect us, but also in the context of what you can do and what the relationships we can have with our investment managers. So you are also subject to federal securities laws. And so there's a whole raft of laws that you have to obey, and that's why you have counsel. That's why you go to educational programs. That's why, because, again, you can't be expected to have all this in mind. I don't know, Karen, you're a public official, that you have a whole other layer of campaign rules and regulations when you run for public office. To me, that would keep me from ever running for public office because of the, you know, just the missteps that you don't even know about, or the pitfalls out there that you can't know about. There are so many rules and regulations that impact what you do. Your obligation, obviously, is to obey the law. So use this, just a couple pages of materials, as kind of a checklist. Look at the first page of the outline, because the Code of Fiduciary Conduct, and we're not going to dwell on these right now, but I highlighted, I bullet pointed or chevroned or whatever you want to call it, on this first part of the outline, excerpted things from our code of conduct and ethics that I thought are really very important that you need to follow. And use this as we have further conversation today and then come up. You know, maybe what I should do is put these on like a little laminated card and leave them at the desk for you to use as a reference next to. Actually, I could make drink coasters out of them. Put them on here. We'll print these bullet points on here, and you could have them at the desk. And refer to them from time to time, just as a reminder. It's kind of a checklist as you go through things. I don't want to go over all of them right now. Talk about conflicts of interest, quiet periods, using your position for personal gain, maintaining confidentiality. So these are all the things that we'll talk about in the real world situation. So let me go to that a little bit. I want to I want to talk about a scenario. I'll call this the adverse litigant scenario. And I'm going to come around here because I don't have it in paper. You don't have it in front of you. I'll just come around here so I can read it with you. Now, this is a hypothetical scenario. It bears no relationship to anyone living or dead. And I want to talk with you about this. Okay? Retired Members Association, the RMA. This is a private association of county retirees. The RMA wants to raise a war chest to challenge a new initiative that's on the ballot that would eliminate COLAs for retirees. The RMA asked the board to authorize deductions from retirees' monthly checks so they can fund their challenge. Right? Comes to the board and says, you know, will you deduct money from retirees' paychecks? The board says, no, we have no authority to do that. So the RMA says, that's not fair. Didn't you read your fiduciary responsibilities? It says you're supposed to have the best interests of members and beneficiaries in mind. We're going to sue you for breach of fiduciary duty. So the RMA sues for breach of fiduciary duty. Hypothetical, fictional individual named Jerry Riggs happens to be...
Is that really Holcomb?
Yeah, right.
No.
More likely.
I told you these are purely hypothetical situations. Yeah. Jerry Riggs is a member of the RMA, and he's elected board trustee. Everybody got the scenario so far? So now the question is, should Jerry recuse himself from the board's discussions about the lawsuit?
Yes.
Deborah? What do you think?
Well, you know,
I... Back to the facts?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Jerry is a member of the RMA, of the Retired Members Association, and he sits on the board. And his association is suing the retirement board. Should Jerry not participate in that conversation?
I believe that he does not have to recuse himself unless he's in some control of the decisions of that organization, i.e. a board position or something to that matter.
Why does that matter to you? Why that distinction?
Because he would be in control of an entity that is suing another entity that he's in control of.
Would it matter if he had no control? He's just the guy that signs the papers. Suppose he was the president of that association. He just signed the papers, but they take all their actions by a vote of their board. Does that matter?
If he was the president of the association?
Yeah.
Well, probably under the law it doesn't matter, but it would matter to me. But that doesn't matter.
Maybe it does matter. Louie, what do you think in this situation?
I think it doesn't matter. I think he can discuss, don't have to recuse himself on this.
He would not have to.
Don't have to, because you got the group that is suing and not the individual. And with the group, he's not in a position to where he can direct the board of that retiree group to make decisions and move that lawsuit to a point to where he's getting both sides.
So your concern is one of strategy, that you're
right.
Worried about the person who can do things to the board, a retirement board?
But if he's the president of the board,
yeah,
of his board, or the RMA board, his strategy can direct that lawsuit in conflict with his retirement system board, sitting on the retirement board. Where if he's just a member, he really doesn't direct that retiree board how to go and go with that lawsuit, basically.
But it, does it bother you that the reason why they filed the lawsuit is to increase his personal retirement benefit?
No, because it affects all retirees. It doesn't affect him. It's just like a regular member making a decision on the board that COLA increases. use that as an example.
Okay.
You make a decision on the COLA, it affects the people that sit on this board, but it affects everybody. It's an overall decision, not just an individual. You might get something from it, but he's not going to, you know what I mean? It's not just personal.
Okay. Will, do you make the same distinction that Louis is?
I see what Louis is saying, but I would say that the person making that decision would probably have to be to his point about his example of it being a broad benefit for all the employees. I don't think he would have to recuse himself. But that's not what this is. This is kind of a little bit different.
Well, this is taking money from all. The proposal in this hypothetical is that money is deducted from all retirees' paychecks.
Right.
To fund, you know, something that the RMA in this situation wants to question.
Right. I don't see a conflict with this.
You don't see a conflict?
Well, there's of course a conflict, but I don't see
but
that
you're
you would
comfortable
have to
recuse. What about a situation where, suppose now you're talking about, well, this RMA had filed a lawsuit and the board says, you know, we don't want to spend money on this. You know, we're supposed to, we have an exclusive benefit rule. We're supposed to spend money on the on delivering benefits. Why don't we try to settle this thing? And this person is in your room and thinking, great, now we got them on the ropes. You know, I'll go back to my people and tell them to tighten down on it. And I'm not going to disclose anything that went on in closed session, but I'm going to go back to my people and give them the impression that they're on the ropes and they think they're going to lose this lawsuit and they want to settle. So let's double down on the pressure. John, what do you think? Does that give you any concern?
Sure. If I'm following this in terms of whether or not, one, on the one hand, you're just a member, second hand, you're in a key position.
Uh-huh.
Key position, I would clearly see is different. If you're solely a member of a large group, to some degree, that's almost inherent in the structure of our board to begin with. It's obviously recognized that some of what is decided by this board will affect some of our members, certainly those who are county employees or have been. And that's inherent in the role. Once you get to the point that you're the spokesperson, you're the decision maker for a group. The second part, and I still didn't quite read it clearly. Authorized deductions, does that mean mandatory or does that mean that the individual still has a choice and can have his or her deduction withdrawn when they elect to have it withdrawn directly?
And would that matter to you?
Oh yeah, I'd see that dramatically differently.
Okay.
One is an administrative ease and the other is an involuntary, certainly to some group, part of the group, that you're going to reduce my pay and take monies and use those for some purpose I may or may not agree with.
Okay. So you'd want some authority from the people who are going to
absolutely
get deducted from. Okay. Well, let's talk about this, and maybe Gabe will help us with this one. What about if you have a young union president who doesn't really care about whether these old people get their COLAs or not, and they're sitting on the board, should they recuse themselves?
No,
because they figure, you know, the county did, or the initiative was put on the ballot to take some pressure off the county so that they could pay higher wages to people like me. And I don't want these people to upset that apple cart, so should that person recuse themselves, Gabe?
Now, based on my training, it doesn't matter if they're a plumber that's appointed or a union thing. They'll have their own agenda, but they need to follow your shared duty and vote accordingly.
Who told you?
Harvey Lieberman.
That's no answer. but how come, are you more comfortable with that person than let's go back to Louis's point that suppose this fellow Jerry Rigged was the RMA president. Are you making a distinction between he should recuse himself?
Based on my training.
And this person should not recuse himself?
It depends on the size of the group of RMA. It depends on whether Jerry's an officer or not. How would I ask those two questions first? What would your answer be to those first two?
Well,
how big is the group?
It's a big group.
100, 1,000?
Yeah, it's big
significant.
Enough.
Significant, okay.
Significant number.
He's got an officer role as a president. I would say that might be enough reason to recuse himself.
But then what about this? The union president. He's got a big role.
Not with the Retirement Association group.
I don't know. Todd, what do you think?
I think the union president has just one hat that he's wearing in terms of the lawsuit. He's not an active participant on both sides. He's only on the board, the retirement board side.
Uh-huh.
So I, you know, it's probably not a nice thing to be thinking, but I wouldn't say you would need to recuse yourself just because of your wishes.
So the union president could harbor his own private thoughts about hoping that the RMA loses its lawsuit. And you're okay with having that person sit on the board?
Well, yeah, because I don't know what anyone's thinking on any given subject. So, you know, we all come from different spots.
Okay. Well, what about the next question? How about the county supervisor? How about the county treasurer? Should they recuse themselves?
I would use the same logic. They're on just one side of this lawsuit, whereas Jerry Rigged had the dual component. So again, I wouldn't have a problem.
Okay.
With that.
Let me change a little bit then. Suppose the county doesn't stay on that one side. The county intervenes in the lawsuit and says, we care about this initiative that we put on the ballot. So we want to join in this and defeat this lawsuit.
Then I think they're getting into the same area as Jerry, where he's making decisions on both sides of the lawsuit. And, you know, it certainly has the appearance of a conflict.
Intervene on it. Like, I don't think the county treasurer is the employer. I think you're looking at two different things. The county treasurer is also a member and will be retiring. So there's actually two hats that person will be having.
Uh-huh. But you're okay with them sitting through this?
Yeah, because they're not the employer that you're talking about. You're associating that position with being the employer.
So where do we draw? I mean, how do we know what's in the best interest of the system here? Scott, Gordon, any bright line you can establish in this for the board in this situation?
Well, it seems to me that the Jerry as RMA president is sort of the easy one. But with the other examples, if the young union president has a strongly held belief about the litigation or the issue or the ballot measure, in this case the lawsuit, and his personal desire for the retirees to lose clouds his judgment, his or her judgment on the issue of discharging the fiduciary duty, then that person should recuse. And it won't be, as Todd was alluding to, it won't be because one of us knows it. It's that person's judgment that I think has to come into play. It's not like we're going to know. I don't know what Karen's thinking, and likewise, the converse is true. But if that person actually believes that and harbors that secret intention in this particular instance about the RMA lawsuit, then that person should recuse themselves. But that's not a decision that someone else makes. That's the decision the person makes. So you have a number of things in that scenario. You've got the rule about if something affects the broader employment base generally, but doesn't affect the board member in a unique way or in a larger way, then at least the law says, 1090 says, there's no conflict. But that third bullet down gets into a different area, and then the fourth bullet, you know, you've got people who sit by designation. So if the county were to intervene and join the lawsuit and take a side, then I think Karen has to recuse in that situation. No offense.
You mean a Karen in
the Yeah,
some
a Karen,
system.
The county supervisor. Well, I got the county treasurer here, and I got the county. So, I mean, I think that once the positions become adverse, what you've got is a divided loyalty problem. You know, you can't serve two masters, right? Uh-huh. So you've got, you know, the county as a body politic sues and intervenes in the litigation on a position. Well, then that person who sits can't have two hats and serve two masters. And in the treasurer's spot, the treasurer might... You know, the county fisc could be affected, perhaps, mm-hmm. you know, the county finances are affected, but if the county treasurer has no office stake in the outcome, then he can vote. If the treasurer takes a public position, though, and either uses his good offices to intervene or publicly, you know, takes a strongly held political position about it, well, then I think he'd probably think about recusing in that situation, because it's to me it's a divided loyalty problem.
Does anybody care about whether or not people who hold these positions secretly disclose it?
Secretly disclose.
Well, no, they have these thoughts. They're motivated. In this case, the union president. Yeah. Okay, the union president is motivated by thinking, you know, I really hope these guys fail because there's going to be more money at the bargaining table for us in our salaries, so I don't want them. But, you know, I don't want to say that to anybody because that'll just tick off the, you know, some of the other people. But does anybody care about whether or not people around the table making decisions about litigation in this instance disclose those beliefs? Disclose those biases?
Well,
are you okay with everybody just quietly having their own thoughts?
Well,
Karen?
The issue for me, and I've got several thoughts here, we pretty much, even in this hypothetical, would know where people stand. And the reason I wouldn't have a problem with the union president or others with who are wearing specific hats recusing themselves is because they're here representing that particular perspective, but they're also here to use their best judgment. So I don't have a problem with that. If the person was the president of the RMA, yes, they have to do that. I still think Jerry should recuse himself, but it goes to what you mentioned earlier about my hat from a political perspective. Our training is anything that creates the possibility of a conflict means you need to recuse yourself. Because it's the perception out there, and this does become political. And I've been thinking through everyone's conversation. We all have a personal interest when we come here, but if you're doing, I mean, what I'm asking myself is, why does Jerry want to stay involved in a discussion where he's on both sides of the issue? Well, he wants to stay involved so he can influence the decision. And that tells me, just because you want to relay, you stay, should you stay? So I would have to say no in that instance.
So for that reason, you'd chuck the union president out of the room?
No. My point, because, well, I know you came up with this scenario, but I see two flaws in it. The union president is never going to disagree with retirees, because one day the union president is going to be a retiree. COLA. And the second,
live that long.
The second part is, this is an initiative. You cannot use public funds
right
in a situation where that is. And so when I heard you say initiative, I thought, first, is it just between the unions? But if it's an initiative where the public is voting on it,
yeah,
to use a public body to withhold deductions, uh-huh, is using public funds to fund something. That's how I would look at it.
It's a retiree's paycheck.
No, you're using a public employee to do the withhold.
The administrative withhold.
Therefore, you cannot do that. But again, I know you came up.
That's a good point.
You came up with, I mean, you're trying to get us to think, and I appreciate that. But no, the union president doesn't.
I would never. Don't accuse me of that.
The union president I don't have a problem with, because they're there for a specific reason and, you know, to represent. But the Jerry of this has too much of a personal investment, as opposed to the others, as you mentioned earlier, when we talked about conflict of interest, if it's a broader group, that's fine. Yeah, Jerry's representing a broader group, but he or she would benefit, or as is required by elected officials, whether you positively benefit or negatively benefit, you have to recuse yourself.
Let's take something you said, and I want to ask Jerry Holcomb about that. Oh. Karen said that everybody around the table represents the constituency. Is that right? In fact,
I think that's
Karen went
true.
Further. Karen said, not only that, I don't care about you disclosing your interests because I know what you are, because I know how you got here. I know exactly what you believe.
Well, I didn't mean it that. Yeah. I meant by based on what I said. You're probably right I said that, but I'm going back to the earliest thing where we have a responsibility to listen and interact.
Karen, you back up as good as you go forward.
You're pointing out to me that I wasn't
tough
clear
room.
In my communication.
Tough room.
I want to clarify that. If I hear from X member, and I've been working with them over a year, I pretty much...
You're predictable.
It's, well, you're right. I'm giving that impression. It's not what I'm trying to say. I'm listening to them through that lens. Maybe that's the better way. When Gabe talks about that we're taking benefits away from beneficiaries, or Will does. I'm like, okay, I try to put myself in their position that they're coming from representing rank and file members, and that is a legitimate belief on their part and their members' part, and I respect that. I can disagree with it, but I respect it. So that's what I'm trying to get at.
Gotcha.
For starters, I'd like to change the name of this Frank or something, you know, Georgette.
You'd like to be Frank with
something. I'd like to be Frank with you rather than Jerry. I think so much of this comes down to not only the impropriety itself, but it's the appearance of impropriety. And so much
appearance to who?
To the outside world.
To the,
to the other board members.
Who cares?
This is
of course
public body.
It is a public body.
Okay.
And I do believe that... Do you want to answer my questions for me, Counselor?
I do. Yeah. I appreciate that.
This is not the first time I've had this happen in my career. I had the attorneys answering for me. That's not what my client really meant to say. But... I think there's a lot of instances in which, people are not going to be able to come in the first day in their job and disclose everything that could possibly be a problem. I'd like to start my first meeting by letting you know every single thing that might be a problem. But as these issues come up, it is incumbent upon the individual who's sitting at the table to make that determination on his or her own. Sitting there thinking to themselves, that's one of the tests for me.
Yeah.
Can I make this decision? Is this going to be viewed by my colleagues or the outside world, and there is an outside world, as having been an odd decision to have participated in? And I rely on my colleagues to make that kind of judgment and evaluation on their own. I mean, not necessarily always disagree with it or agree with it, but I rely on you to do it.
But if the young union president, to me, who sits on the board and who harbors a desire that the retirees lose in this case,
mm-hmm.
but otherwise doesn't take any action, seems to me... it's a decision that he or she has to make about whether to recuse, because only they know if it'll cloud their judgment. But our golden rule, at least the one that I've been taught that governs us, is do no harm, right? The first order of fiduciary hierarchy is do no harm. So if the union president does nothing more than kind of internally think, God, I really hope the retirees lose this case, but takes no overt action, and in fact... takes every step or every vote to defend the interests of the pension board in the litigation, then that person is discharging their fiduciary responsibility because they didn't allow another belief or a desire to cloud their judgment about discharging their fiduciary obligation. So in that instance, I could make the argument that I don't know that that person would have to recuse if it didn't cloud their judgment and affect their thinking and affect their decision-making about the lawsuit.
Well, don't you think it would affect their decision-making? I mean, suppose some of the board members say, we spent $100,000 on this litigation already. It's a rat hole. It's going to go on for another 2 years. Why don't we just settle this damn thing and come up with some mechanism that they can use? And this person says, hell no, not a penny in tribute. We should fight them to the death.
Right. So,
yeah, and you'll never know what's motivating.
Well, you
them.
Won't, and that's why ultimately this is, you know, the do no harm command really is something that we uniquely control amongst us. We know if we harbor that. What's it called? Compartmentalizing. You can have a thought about what you want an outcome to be, or what you think it should be, or what you might bet it would be if you were mm-hmm. a betting person. But you can also conduct yourself in a different way in discharging your obligation. You might think or wish one thing, but, quote, do the right thing. I could see someone doing that. So I'd make that counterargument.
You've only one vote.
That's why we're stereotyping everybody, because Karen said you got the union president who's going to want to benefit in retirement, so is the supervisor, so is the treasurer.
Sure,
so.
Right.
That's why I think a lot of times when you put these, you're definitely stereotyping these people, when in fact maybe that's not right either. I think everybody's got their own set of values. We may all benefit, we may not benefit from it.
And part of the resolution of that is to make sure you have an open and robust conversation where people get to express their values and people just don't come to a conclusion that, well, there's five of you I know are going to vote this way and five of the other, that you have an interchange and make a collective decision on these things. And trust each other to make the right call where you feel like you can't be independent or exercise, you know, clear judgment in a situation. Let's move on to another scenario.
Thank God.
This is going to be you to see
it. Jerry again?
Oh, I'm Jerry.
Is it another Jerry?
Let's move into a scenario where I'll speak for Mr. Holcomb.
Oh, good.
Actuarial scenario. Okay, we're going to talk about actuarial stuff for a few minutes. You've just been appointed by the county supervisors to this board. A board, excuse me. The actuary is due to come to the next meeting to discuss the assumed rate of return. Is expected to recommend dropping 50 basis points off the expected rate of returns in the terrible markets. You know the actuaries head in that direction. You're a brand new appointee to the retirement board. You call the chair of the board of supervisors to ask how you should vote.
And once you do that, the chair says we're unappointing you.
You won't
Sorry.
Have to worry about it.
Problems? Anybody got any issues so far with this?
Yeah.
Second half.
Forget the fact that you're not
don't
competent.
Don't all raise your hands at once.
Karen summed it up pretty well.
Ms. Allen?
In all fairness, that's a perfectly valid question of a brand new trustee to this board that hasn't been through this fiduciary training. So I would hope that the supervisor's answer would be, we really can't discuss this and you need to do your own research and you know, look at the facts.
The chair of the board of supervisors should say, we shouldn't discuss this, look at your facts. Is that what you were saying?
Right.
Chair of the board of supervisors has no free speech rights here. Can't have a conversation even?
I mean, yeah, maybe. I think the chair of the board of supervisors is considered a sponsor representative,
uh-huh.
right, for one of our plan sponsors. And the conflict occurs because that chair is representing the plan sponsor, where the plan sponsor is going to incur a substantial additional cost, an employment cost, by this action. And so there's somewhat of a conflict in that chair advising another board member. I mean, in open session, I think, you know, certainly that chair can give their opinion, and they certainly will.
No, they won't.
Well, it happened.
is your concern the non-public nature of the conversation, not that the conversation takes place, or is that it?
Well, again, I think it's a legitimate question, but I think that the board chair has some conflict in advising appointed, because they have the control over appointing the board members here. So they have some conflict in terms of trying to persuade their appointed members in one direction or another. Having the conversation of what the facts are probably doesn't violate anything, but giving you know, advice on it should be this and you should do this might.
I think he should, even though he's new, he should sit down, listen to the actuary, and look at the recommendations of the actuary, why the actuary is saying what he's saying, and vote accordingly.
But would you expect the actuary to say what the county's fiscal condition is?
No, but the, but he's saying this, the, he has to be looking for the funds. Okay, what's the fund? You have to keep the fund whole. The county, if it has financial problems, it has financial problems. He shouldn't be concerned with that. He should be concerned with the fund.
Brian, no concern about the county's financial condition when setting actuarial rates?
No.
None?
They developed the benefit scheme. They had the responsibility to pay for it. With regards to whether or not the fund is expected to earn X amount of money, shouldn't be dependent on the employer or the plan sponsor's ability to pay for that. With regards to the question you call the chair of the Board of Supervisors and ask how to vote, I don't see a problem calling the chair of the Board of Supervisors and having a discussion about this. Giving them, asking them how you should vote on this issue, I think is improper giving up of your independence.
But certainly, the question be, what should I know about the county's situation?
Or how is this going to affect you?
How should I vote?
Right. Now, whether
you would take the...
Now, whether or not that information, I mean, just as, you know, being a well-informed trustee, I think you get information from various sources about various things. Some of the information that you get isn't really applicable and you're making a decision, but it's helpful to have it. The chair of the Board of Supervisors, if you know, somebody called them up and if they hadn't had a seat on a retirement board, may go, what are you talking about? I have no idea what 50 basis point reduction is going to do to me.
Okay.
And what's a basis point?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's see what happens in our hypothetical situation. The chair of the supervisor says, you know, I'm glad you called. Come on over to my office tomorrow. The other trustees that we've appointed are coming over to talk about this, and you should join us. John finds that humorous?
Well, it looks very unindependent to me. Brian really touched on all the issues that struck me on the slide before that basically I want to understand how this will, what impact this would have in the county is hardly unreasonable as part of the thinking process. But once you say, how should I vote, then you're obviously not an independent trustee in that regard. And so I wouldn't support. Now, all of a sudden, when you start getting into a group discussion that is just the group of appointees, I think that has a variety of things that we have learned under other circumstances that we shouldn't be doing, that is having a non-public partial trustee meeting to begin with, but I just immediately my instincts are you shouldn't do that.
Shouldn't do that. It's not a majority of the board.
No, it's not.
Well,
I mean, the board, the chair, the supervisor, a very busy person, right? You want them to have one meeting with one and one meeting with them. Why can't they get together and talk?
Well, I would immediately think that now you're going from an informational process to a
serial arm twisting.
We'd like you to do process for
slope.
Purposes independent of your fiduciary duty.
Karen, how do we know when a slippery slope is a slippery slope?
It feels yucky. I'm serious.
Not in the minutes. Yeah.
No.
You know it when you see it.
I can tell you, as many of you know, I sit on IO, and I know others have. One of the first questions we ask our people who are coming in is, we're looking for independent thinkers. So it's absolutely not okay that a trustee would call a member of the board and ask, how should I vote? I appreciate that that would be a... But we've already screened for that. This is totally inappropriate by the chair to say, come on over, because why I say slippery slope, again, it's perception. People see that happening. It leads to the minds of the appointed individuals that they have to go to the board or at least some supervisor to find out what we need to know more information before we vote here. my expectation is that a person appointed by the board would do their own investigation and their own analysis and what have you, and as Louis said, come to the meeting. I mean, I appreciate the scenario, but I can tell you none of my colleagues would tolerate this.
I want to parenthetically say here, you may find this ludicrous.
Okay.
Every example that I will put on the screen
has happened.
Has happened within the last year.
No,
in
this state.
No, I believe you, Harvey. I believe you because I go to County Supervisors Association meetings, and I am amazed at my colleagues and what they're dealing with in other parts of the state. And I mean, I literally during my training 4 years ago, a new supervisor. We got together right after we'd been elected and then after we'd served 3 months. And it was, what have you learned that really surprised you the most? And this supervisor's answer was, didn't realize I didn't have impact on who got contracts and how they were awarded.
That's why I got elected, right?
Hope it was from a small county.
Yes, it was. Wow. It was from a small rural county.
Wow.
And it just pointed out to me, this is why people don't trust elected officials, and yet they thought that was okay.
Yeah, well, you know, that's small case. Yeah.
And he was actually reelected. I'm amazed. But anyway, so I am not surprised that this has happened because nobody said you had to be smart to run and be an elected official, unfortunately.
Okay. So let's follow it up now. So I'm getting the sense from the board that you kind of a little squeamish about this scenario where everybody's trooping over to the supervisors to talk about whether you should drop it 50 basis points, right? So here's what happens. You go to that meeting with the appointees. Supervisor says, I respect your fiduciary duties. Now, one of those duties is to minimize employer contributions, and that means you can't vote to drop the assumed investment return because that will increase our contributions. And with that logic, they all agree. Make sense to you?
There's the slippery slope.
Well, what's
plain wrong?
Because they came into the office to begin with thinking that they were going to get some information.
Uh-huh. And this sounds very persuasive to me.
But the supervisor has misstated what the obligation is.
Well. Mm-hmm. Will's got a question.
Well,
I'm sorry. It makes sense. I think that everyone just has a misunderstanding of costs in this situation.
Their responsibility is to the system, not to the public or the board. And so that's in direct conflict with that.
But it's right there in the Constitution. It says you have a duty to minimize employer contributions.
No, it's in direct conflict. Because because that will increase the county's contribution. It's in conflict. It's soliciting.
Dropping the assumed rate of return increase county contributions.
Yes.
Sure. And employee contributions.
And employee,
and then funded liability.
Per year.
Does it matter what methodology you use to amortize it over time?
Short-term or long-term?
Short-term, long-term. I mean, what is minimizing contributions?
It's all based on normal cost. I guess it will impact it.
Would affect the normal cost.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go forward. So the appointees have now agreed. At the next board meeting, the agenda is very long. Actuary doesn't get on until 2:30 in the afternoon, and the chair says, get on with it. Get on to the conclusions. The actuary says, okay, forget my 50 slides. Let's drop the assumed rate of return. I recommend dropping it 50 basis points. And you're the new trustee. And you say, wow, this is one hot potato. I am sitting this one out.
As you advise us, you don't get to abstain.
We've been there.
Yeah. You abstain from the most important deadlock.
We've seen this one.
Board deadlock's 4-4, and there is a long silence. So, any comments on this? Everybody okay with this scenario?
Nope.
Anybody got problems? Anybody got milk? What do you got?
You don't get to abstain.
You want to talk about abstention?
Right.
Let's talk about abstention. What's wrong with that? They're not in a position to vote. They say, you know, I don't want to, it's my first vote. I don't want to get involved in this.
But that's not a legitimate reason. That's why a lot of people like to abstain, is they don't want to get in the hot seat. To me, you either have to recuse yourself because you have a conflict of interest, or you sit there and you make a decision, one way or the other. You don't get to abstain. I think abstain is a archaic thing because it doesn't apply anymore, especially in our laws here in California as it relates to public bodies. That's why we have conflicts of interest and recusal. You know, you either can or you can't. And if you can't, you're gone. And if you can, you sit there and you make the difficult decision.
Lou, you got a comment on that?
Well, I got a problem with the chair.
Well, let's stay with the abstain for a minute. I want to come back to your problem with the chair. Rusty's got it.
Again, say it's gone on for all morning long, and you still haven't come to a consensus, whether to vote or for or against it. And you're in doubt or feel like you need more information, but yet the chair's wanting to rush through the decision.
Okay.
Should you still vote even though you're still in doubt or not certain about
the decision? Vote no, I guess. Or you try to convince your colleagues to continue.
Right, continue.
If you don't have enough information, I'd put that out on the record.
Good.
I don't have enough information to make this decision, and I feel the chair and or others are rushing us through this, so I would like to continue it. You put that out there. I mean, it's a political thing, but you put that out there, and all of a sudden, people have to deal with that.
So the obligation...
It's a strategy.
Actually, there is a legal obligation as a fiduciary. You notice in the Constitution and in the way the law is stated for your responsibilities that there's a use of active verbs. You know, you shall manage, the trustee shall manage the system, you shall administer the system. It's all in an active verb sense. And there's a reason why it's written that way. It's because as a fiduciary, you have an obligation to affirmatively act, not to refrain from acting. It's a general matter. And so generally speaking, you really should not be abstaining because it's a derogation of your responsibility as a fiduciary. Unless you have a conflict of interest or something like that. But let's drill down for a minute about this lack of information issue, or this is going too fast. Because there are many situations where that comes up. Mm-hmm. And people will say, you know what, I need to know more. I'm hearing slide 1 through 36 from the actuary, and I don't get it. I have another county system that's in the middle of the same actuarial scenario right now, and there's one board member who has sent out a list of interrogatories. You know, 30 questions that they want granular answers from Paul Angelo on about how did you get to this? You know, what's a confidence level? How do you get the inflation rate? How do you get... And they feel that they cannot vote until they get answers to all those questions. So what's your sense about... You know, should a chair bring it, you know, what's the responsibility here? At what point should the chair bring a vote on,
if some of
the members are not comfortable with the level of information that they have?
Well, there's two things going on. If you don't have enough information, you should share that with your colleagues. And hopefully, and we've had that happen here where people have said that, and we've continued the item. On the other hand, if I had a board member who was sending out 30 interrogatories and drilling down to that level and everybody else got it, you know, the chair is to manage me. But that's why when you call the question, you never vote on calling the question, because once somebody calls the question according to Robert's Rules of Order, you have to take the vote. So at that point, going back to your scenario, if the person didn't know, they're going to have to make a decision, you know, you can't force them not to abstain, but I think you would have had enough discussion on the record to indicate that this person was either being ridiculously wanting 30 questions answered. Then they shouldn't probably be serving on the board if they've got that many questions, because they should have talked to them ahead of time. So. I don't think it's appropriate for a chair to start out saying, this is, you know, hurry up, get to the conclusion. But if you've been discussing something for a half hour and the body's looking at itself, you know, some people like to call a question because they don't want further discussion. You know, there's good reasons to do that and there's not good reasons to do that. But hopefully, you know, you need a presentation for one thing on something like this. You don't start out.
And everybody knows how everybody's voting on these things.
But we have, I mean...
Everybody knows how you're all voting on these
kinds. No, they don't.
Board members are voting on these things, right?
No.
But part of our fiduciary obligation is to consider many of our policies. We're obligated to consider the information from our actuary. We can't make a decision without making that call, without taking that into consideration. So here, the chair would be violating, you know, one or more rules, certainly his or her own fiduciary duty to allow the process to play out and allow the allow the actuary to present information which one or more board members would find appropriate. So, you know,
that was Louis' point, I think you were getting to, right?
Yeah. I mean, the chair shouldn't say, okay, get to the conclusion. You got a presentation, have him make the presentation. If you don't want to sit there and listen, continue it to the next meeting. I mean, there's nothing that says you can't continue it. To have board members not having the information they need to make a decision, and that's what you're doing by get to the conclusion. There's all he's going to say, hey, get a raise of 50 basis points.
So that part is, it works against everybody because it's denying you the opportunity to educate yourself on the issue.
Of what they, yes.
What about the person who says, it's not I don't have enough information. I don't like the optics of this. Are you okay with that abstention?
No.
No.
They went down.
No, I think he has an obligation, like we talked about. Either vote yes or vote no. I mean, that's...
Well, let's see what happens at this hypothetical board meeting after the long silence.
Is this Jerry again?
Jerry. our new trustee sends a text message across the table to another trustee and says, you know, we got to get on with this. I'll vote to change the assumed rate if on the next vote you agree to shorten the UAAL amortization. And then, you know, it'll come out. That'll sort of balance itself out, right, in terms of contributions. And a text message comes back and says, yeah, that's a great idea. So you make a motion to reconsider.
That violates the Brown Act.
Okay, let's go. You make a motion to reconsider, and the assumed rate passes miraculously 5-4 this time. Cool. Somebody threw up the red card on the side of the table. Was it Karen?
Yeah.
Violates the Brown Act.
Sending a text violates the Brown Act. You're communicating with a number, but another member of the body, and the public is not privy to that conversation.
Get him, Karen. Get him.
I'm sorry. We've had this happen. Not in our board, but I think I've gone through AB 1234 training like 5 times now.
Heard some stories.
The issue of texting comes up a lot. Condition. It violates the Brown Act.
You mean to tell me that nobody on our hypothetical board ever talked to another member of the board about anything?
I may talk with members of the audience, but I don't talk to
members
of my
board. Of the board?
Well, we're talking right now, but we're not texting. We're talking.
Well, that's directly. It, because it's public and people can hear. Texting
is... Take it out of this thing. There's a 10-minute break, and board members go around the corner into the coffee alcove, and one board member says to the other, here he is.
Just like Will did.
Purely hypothetical. Now we're going to see who comes out.
Gabe's coming in through that, going, oh, Gabe's already here.
And they say, God, you know, we got to get on with this. How are you going to vote on this? And the other one says, I'm going to vote against it. You know, really? That's never happened? Everybody knows that's a verboten violation of the Brown Act, and they wouldn't do it? Either in the coffee room or... having a cigarette outside.
Well, now it doesn't. You know, maybe I'm being a little bit, because two people communicating. But if you're in session, you shouldn't be doing that. If you're out of session,
it's better to do it out of session.
Well, no, let me finish. It's not okay. Better, but it happens, and there's nothing wrong with that because when they come back, they need to explain again, going to what Deborah was mentioning earlier on the reconsideration. You know, I know because you had to have voted to do it that quickly. When you advised us, we can always take something up. A current board isn't obligated by a future board. But if something comes up 10 minutes after you just had a vote, you do have to follow Robert's rules, and it has to be somebody who voted in the negative to bring it up again. So,
okay, so you're going to have to be... You're throwing the Robert's rules red card on the last part of this.
Well, no, right, because the first part, that doesn't violate the Brown Act. I mean, it's a technicality. It's trading votes, and that's wrong to begin with.
Yeah, that's...
You know, but if somebody goes out during a coffee break and says, hey, you know, you do this, I'll do that, let's break the stalemate, blah, 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 and they go, okay, fine. You know, they still have to come in under public session and talk about it and make the motion, and it's discussed again.
Trading votes. This will come as some news to the people in Sacramento and Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
I didn't know they weren't supposed to do that.
So, Brian, is this how much you're... Member of our honorable bar, is this so much a matter of law or governance? You're sitting in the chair role as well.
This is not technically a violation of the Brown Act, unless you're group texting. but it's certainly, it's distasteful. I'm not saying that I'm not naive enough to think that this doesn't happen.
There are two things happening here. I want to make sure which one or both are distasteful to you. Sending a text during a board meeting to each other?
No, not a problem.
Not a problem.
Not legally a problem.
But governance wise?
Probably. If you're present, you might, and you have something you want to discuss with somebody, it should be an open session. Or if it's some, you know, if you want to go to dinner tonight, you know, that sort of thing.
So instead of Jerry texting Gabe in this situation, you'd rather he shout across the table, Gabe.
Well, it depends on what they're discussing.
Oh,
if they're discussing
an
issue that's before the board, then the discussion should be open.
Is Scott sending somebody a text right now?
See if I got any. He's
sending it to Gabe.
Russ is looking at his tablet.
I got it. Okay. There you go. Thank you, Scott.
In a best case scenario, I mean, take the texting out of it. I mean, somebody could I could lean over to Scott and say something. You could say something to me.
Right.
Again, it depends on what the topic is. It's not a violation of the Brown Act if the two of us agree to do something.
How about the trading part of this? You got a problem with that, Louis?
I do.
Didn't this go on all the time?
Yeah, but I think what they're doing is, well, you do this, I'll do this. Now, what are the other board members thinking? Okay, my thing is, okay, he wants to do this. He's going to vote no on this. If I vote yes on this, I mean, yeah, they're negotiating, but is that, I mean, moral, basically. I got a moral problem with it.
Can I look at my outline and see if morality is on that chart? Is morality on that chart? I don't see morality, but do you want to put it in the board's guidelines?
No, but I just feel that it's improper for him to say, oh, I'll give you my vote, you give me your vote here to get something, to get that.
I take it everybody's pretty uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
With that kind of thing. And the communications, I mean, this really is, I go back to the issue, how do you want to govern yourself, even if it's not a technical violation? I've heard a lot of conversation about appearance and how it feels to the outside world about these kind of things. But what about the way you want to govern yourselves? I mean, do you want this kind of behavior going on even if it's not technically unlawful? Is it a good way, is it a prudent way to manage yourself as a collective decision-making body?
No, it may be more expedient, but it's not the proper way to do it.
It may be more expedient, yeah. And there is that.
Shorten the meetings quite.
Well, I mean, like, Harvey, like you're saying.
You can't accuse this board of being...
like you're saying, okay, and you're selling the votes. There's times where people talk to each other, you know, I can do this, you know, I don't like this, but I'd rather have this, and I think I could vote for this at this, but I ain't saying you vote for this, I'll vote for that.
Right.
I mean, we're discussing that, hey, I think I can change my vote if I can get this, and it's not saying you got to change your vote. It's a discussion saying this is how I would go if I can get this.
And where should that discussion take place?
The give and take?
You know, Louie, come on. That's a softball.
Yeah.
Well, you could have the discussion outside, but then you have to reiterate the discussion,
discussion inside.
And there are ways to do that, to inform the public. And if the, you know, the rest of the body is smart enough, they're going to figure it out. And that's where you start having the conversation and or questioning of, wait a minute, 10 minutes ago you did this. We had a break. I mean, that's how I'd handle it. What happened in those 10 minutes?
Well, I thought about it, and I feel that I can get this. And yeah, you'll have the public
discussion.
I'll give
you a real-life scenario that happened about 2 months ago elsewhere, and that wasn't a text across a table at the dais, but it was a text out to somebody else saying, here's what we're about to do. What do you think I should do? Now, the interesting thing, just to scare the bejesus out of you, is that when you're sending texts like that, those are public records. It's subject to a public records request. Somebody could serve you with a public records request in an instant like that, and you have 10 days to tell them whether you're going to produce it or not. And if you don't, the legal fees are you pay to somebody else. Kind of interesting. So there is some downside besides governance issues here to those kind of communications. I'm going to wrap it up with the last page of the scenario. The amortization issue is called. The retiree trustee makes a motion to shorten the period to 5 years. The amortization to 5 years says, it's time we got this plan fully funded. I don't care what happens to the county. Even if they have to fire all the employees, my job, it says right here, is to get as much money in this fund as I can for the retirees.
Shouldn't that be the right? the new retiree trustee?
This is
the recently retired
retiree trustee. All right.
Yeah. You know, I don't have a problem with it. Should a person make that comment? Because it's out there. We know what they're thinking. We know what they're feeling. And that's great. Then you can deal with it. If it gets a second and you have a discussion, what have you. I mean, I would not agree with that position, but I don't have a problem with somebody saying that.
Is there a conflict because we have a duty to the county and to the members? Something doesn't sound right with that, though.
Yeah, it is a kind.
Well, first of all, isn't there a real mechanical issue here? Because if you fire all the employees, you're not collecting any contribution.
Well, yeah. And somebody would...
So the retiree was not the brightest light in the in the pack.
But he has a fiduciary responsibility to the system, not just the retirees.
Well, everybody's going to be a retiree, right? It's
the
only time you ever.
But you're the employer. I mean,
as much money in this.
You got all the members
that
he has a fiduciary responsibility to, not just his retirees.
That's a.
And to come out in public, he's not doing his fiduciary responsibility by saying that out loud. I mean,
he shouldn't.
You don't like him saying it out loud?
But if he does, I don't have a problem with it.
Well, you like him to say it out loud, and then you'll deal with it. You don't think he should have the thought in the first place.
Right. I think it's a violation
of him
saying that. I mean, can he be sanctioned for not doing his fiduciary responsibility by that statement?
Well, Scott, what do you think? Can he be sanctioned?
I think you can't fix stupid. I mean, if he
can't get a writ for stupid. Huh?
If he doesn't see that, you know, that's a murder suicide, then it's sort of, I can't help him. I lean to Karen's view, which is that I, you know, the good news is he said it, he or she said it publicly. They took a position and made a motion. Don't know if it got a second. I can't remember.
Doesn't say you got a second.
So, you know, it at least it got out on the table. Is it the right approach? No. Does it benefit all of the members? Does it benefit, quote, the members, the system? No. Yes, everyone will become a retiree, but if I'm an active member, I kind of give a damn about what the unfunded liability is, what the obligations of the system are, and what's going to be there when I get there as an active member. So our view should be the benefit of the system as a whole. You have a holistic approach. You know, Jerry doesn't come here to my right, not Jerry Rigby, Jerry Tellis, and simply try to sway every vote for the benefit of the retirees. That's not what he does. It just, I mean, I know I got specific.
This is one of the hardest jobs that these boards have, that you have as board members. And it's the generational issue. It's the, we're sort of used to historically thinking of members, as, you know, and the Constitution talks about members and beneficiaries. And then we don't realize that, especially in times of fiscal strain, that there are real stresses and identity issues between what's good for active members of the system, what's good for people who are already retired.
And what's good for the employer.
What's good for the employer. And we're actually in litigation in Stanislaus County next month on this very issue. When the board made actuarial decisions after the financial crisis, that the retirees felt hurt them, the active members felt saved their jobs. And you start seeing the tensions. You know, you're supposed to act on behalf of all members today and tomorrow and try to figure out where that balance is. It is a very, very difficult job to try to balance those things. But, you know, you're right to identify in this scenario that the obligation is more than to just the group that sent you to this table.
And one disagreement we've had on is the whole taxpayer issue. It's been mentioned we're supposed to be protecting the taxpayers. What's your take on all that?
Who mentioned that?
There is a body out there that has the obligation to protect taxpayers. It's in this county, for example. That's the Board of Supervisors of the county. We have, this board has no obligation to taxpayers. This board has a singular obligation to fund the benefits that the employers promised their members, not to make policy decisions whether those were good promises, bad promises, hurt taxpayers, help taxpayers. You will hear from the actuaries their talk about intergenerational equity in this generation of taxpayers. Those are not your fiduciary responsibilities. Those are methodologies once you establish the bases for your rates to move things around on a time basis, either front load the cost, back load the cost, spread it out, level percent of pay, all those methodologies that actuaries use. Those are meant to take into account the plan sponsor's ability to pay. I mean, you don't want to kill the county. They're the guarantor of the obligation. On the other hand, you can't say, well, don't pay us anything. So, but the obligation is, if this board is not to taxpayers, somebody else has a responsibility to taxpayers. This is a board of trustees for this, for the pension.
So I want to interject a comment because this has been written in letters to county supervisors and bounced around among a number of labor groups regarding one specific comment that I made in one meeting in July where I explained a certain thing that was going on here that I felt was costing more money than it should, and I ended that explanation with, on the backs of the taxpayers. That comment was then taken and out of context and twisted into statements that were put in writing to public officials stating that I said my job here was to protect the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. So I want to clear that right now on the public record. I never made that statement. I never said I was here to protect the taxpayer, okay? What I probably, maybe I, if I had it to do over again, I'd probably pick different words and I wouldn't say on the backs of the taxpayers, but what I was intending to say was, this was a costly item that we needed to change, okay? And maybe I should have said it's costly to the system, which ends up being costly to the employers and the employees, participants, and everyone involved. Okay, but I wanted to take this opportunity because I think, you know, I keep hearing this thing come back to me, and so I just want to clear the record of what I meant by that comment and how I actually believe my job here is the fiduciary obligations to the entire system as a whole, whether that's retirees, current participants, plan sponsors,
Okay.
Thank you. So it's a very difficult job. Well, I mean, you folks are not paid anywhere near what you
I don't want to talk about pay. You want to make $3 an hour?
But let me take that one step further.
Please.
And say that we all, from time to time on this board, say things that don't come out the right way. We're given a short amount of time to make our points and move on, and the meetings are long enough without us belaboring things. And so sometimes we do say things that maybe aren't exactly the right choice of words. But the comment that you made earlier in the session about we should all be comfortable expressing what we think, and that's sort of the beauty of this board and the beauty of the system, I think, by putting all of these different interests in the same room, is that we do go back and forth and we don't agree on things, and we all have the opportunity to say what we think and express our own ideas. But when a person on this board says something that isn't exactly said the right way, but then it gets blown into something entirely different by other interests, that really puts a big damper on people actually expressing what they're thinking and why they're voting.
That's a good point. I mean, this board acts as a collective whole, has to act as an organism. And I go back to something very simple I said before, which is you have to be able to trust and respect each other and talk to each other. Part of the underlying a lot of these slides that we haven't spent any time really talking about too much is the obligation to disclose. I mean, we had some conversation months ago, maybe a year or so ago, about if you're meeting, you know, if investment managers, you know, are picking up the phone and calling you saying, you know, how do we get onto your portfolio and run money for you, that sort of thing. I think you all agreed that it was good to disclose that to each other, that somebody has contacted me because you don't know if they contacted Gabe and Jerry and Scott and Brian, you know, and that went on. And suddenly you're in a situation where, you know, you've got a meeting outside the process. But it's that kind of disclosure that's very important. On that issue and a million other issues, that if you have an interest or if you've had a communication, you know, we're talking here about a communication with the chair of the Board of Supervisors or something like that, you need to think about making that disclosure to the rest of the board, because the board needs to know that when you walk in the room, each of you want to know that each of the rest of you are going to be acting as impartially as possible. I'm not a Pollyanna about this. I know everybody has their interests. But
you have the same information.
You also know that you're putting some constraints on yourself as well. And you want to know that all your other colleagues are coming to this table with a sense of fairness and openness to the process and let people express their views. And if you feel a restraint that you can't express yourself, then board members start, two things happen. Board members stop talking to each other and telling them what their opinions are. And so I've seen that. We've got another client system, it's a city system, where we can't even get anybody to make a motion, let alone talk about a motion. I mean, the chair says, do I hear a motion on this? and they videotape, they broadcast. I'll bring in a clip somewhere, but you'll see this. It's the most embarrassing thing. And then finally you get a motion in a second, and nobody says boo. There's no discussion at all, and they vote. They have no idea what each other is thinking. The other thing is that if you don't express yourself in the meeting, people start projecting onto you your position.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
And then they start acting based on the projection on you, and it just, you know, creates a cycle. So, I mean, wrapping it up, ask yourself, are you acting independently? That's kind of key. We talked about, do I have all the information I should have? You have an obligation to go out, we talked about prudent expert rule, you have an obligation to develop an expertise, either yourself or the people you delegate to. Have I disclosed what I should? Do I have a personal financial interest in this? Is it short? Is it remote? Is it little? Is it a great interest? And then ultimately, am I acting for the benefit of the system and all of its members? I'll make this available to you in sepia prints that you can put on your table. But and this has been a very good conversation from my perspective, and I appreciate it. And we can talk about any questions you have about the process, or we can continue the conversation at another time. And thank you for letting me bring it to you.
Thank you. Harvey, I just want to say thanks for doing this, but I think this is something like we need to do like every 2 years or every year.
We do.
Yeah, do we?
No, every 2 weeks.
I don't know where you're going.
No. Well, Jerry may need it every 2 weeks.
Hey, that one over there.
The other Jerry.
There I am. Hang on.
Jerry Rigg over here.
Yeah. Jerry Rigg.
Okay. take a moment.
Very good, Harvey. That was very good.
Thank you, Harvey.
All right. Yep. Thank you, everybody.
Good show.
I think we're adjourned.
We'll see you all next week.
I have a question.
Oh, it's too late. We're always here.
Do any of our scenarios wind up in your slides or your presentations for other groups? Do our hypotheticals wind up in your slides when you're doing OSERS or somebody else?
One more time, right?
Don't answer that.
He's not giving that up.